got a major disinformation campaign, which has basically fooled mental health professions and the general public concerning brainwashing, concerning LSD. Fortunately, those are the only two examples in human history. This analysis does not apply to the false memory movement. There is no way that it could conceivably be possible, you'll all agree, that there could be any nervousness in the intelligence community about Manchurian candidates spilling out into civilian psychotherapies, and that a disinformation program based on false memories would be required. That's obviously absurd. Nobody but a CIA conspiracy nut would ever suggest that. So I can guarantee you that that thought has never even crossed my mind until it just spontaneously appeared at this moment. So you see, in fact, the idea that there could be a deliberate disinformation campaign element to the false memory movement is perfectly plausible, consistent with history, and to be expected. There is bound to be some sort of disinformation strategy if, in fact, Manchurian candidates have been leaking out into civilian psychotherapies. So here we have, with all of this documentation, all of this proof, we know that it is perfectly possible that people we are seeing in therapy who are claiming to be victims of systematic military mind control experimentation are telling us about what actually happened to them. However, I'm not a single step further ahead than I was 4 years ago on actually documenting that any single individual patient in treatment actually in fact was involved in these mind control experiments. There is no linkage at all from the current patients in treatment to this documentation. So whether we're ever going to get that or not, I don't know. Okay, so America Online has a site called On Psych Online, yeah. And
if you get into some of the forums, the groups,
right.
There is a group called Mind Control in the Military.
Okay. So Mind Control in the Military is a chat group on the internet.
It's a chat group. It's not in the room, but it's where they respond to other writers.
That's like a bulletin board more? Those of us who are not internet wizards are all having trouble with this vocabulary. But anyway, you're able to access through America Online onto the internet, or it's an America Online?
Online, on psych.
On psych. Okay. And there's a bunch of websites. Apparently there's a lot of info about this, you know, in the web and the internet and America Online and elsewhere. But the problem is, I don't go to chat rooms that much, but the little bit I've gone is it's mostly just totally banal and silly and boring and a waste of time. So when you go into the stuff on mind control, how much just garbage are you going to get, and how much solid stuff that you can pursue and document are you going to get is my question. I have no idea what the answer is. But as we all know, the truth is out there.
I'm curious, you said you haven't had an opportunity or you haven't had a case where you've been able to document. I'm curious, how would you go about doing
that? How would I go about documenting that a patient that I currently have in treatment or somebody else currently has in treatment in fact was involved in that kind of experimentation? Well, here's how the documentation has gone so far. The person has, by the way, I've done Freedom of Information Act requests on Monarch at all intelligence agencies and they've all denied that it exists. The patient has apparently no source of contamination for specific Monarch memories, but has the word Monarch in her mind and has a very detailed Monarch mind control type scenario memories. Her father basically abused her domestically and ritualistically and then took her over to the mind control people. How she got there, what the transport mechanism was, plane and car, the location's all vague because she appears to have been drugged out during transport. Is it possible that her father could have been this kind of person? Well, I have his military service record, which I got through the Freedom of Information Act. I have a letter from him in prison where he's imprisoned for mob crime connections. I've got a mother and a sister corroborating the domestic incest, a sister with some patchy corroboration of ritual abuse and military mind control memories. I've got the father personally connected to Jack Ruby. That's as far as it goes.
Okay.
it's sort of circumstantial, intriguing. So the way that I would attempt to document it would be, if the person tells me, most people can't tell you the specific name of the doctor, but if somebody gives you the specific name of a doctor and gives you a specific location, and then you can establish that this doctor actually existed, then you can establish that in fact the doctor was a CIA employee. Then you can establish that this person's father was imprisoned by the FBI as part of a mafia raid by looking at the journal articles that the patient has. Then you're starting to get closer and closer. So it's your basic investigative reporting type stuff. Name a specific base. Okay, what do you know about the base? How did you get there? Tell me about some buildings. Tell me about personnel. Describe uniforms. What was used? And then if you can get another subject who is at the same time, that's just the way it is. It's your basic investigative reporting, which is way beyond being a therapist. I mean, there's no therapeutic obligation to do this. This is like mega beyond duty to take collateral history. But I don't think there's any mystery as to how it would proceed. And it'll proceed probably in the same way as the history of declassified information has gone since the Second World War. In about 1988, stuff was released to the Senate and the Congress and then was released to the press about all these radiation experiments. But like, nobody did anything. It didn't even get into the newspapers. It's been in the public domain for 5 years before it finally hits the newspapers. Now I've got this government report that's 900 pages on all the radiation experiments, includes giving radiation to children and radiation to pregnant mothers and the children of those pregnancies dying of leukemia by age 5. I mean, this is huge, big stuff. There was just, everybody was apathetic, didn't think it was really newsworthy, didn't even put it as a little trailer item, you know, in the New York Times. But this is no longer vague. We know the specific names of the people, when they died, whether it was plutonium or what it was that was injected, the names of the doctors, the medical schools it was done at, and it's all teed up for compensation. The government has set up a whole compensation mechanism. If we look at the Tuskegee syphilis study, anybody ever heard of the Tuskegee syphilis study? Tuskegee syphilis study is worse than creation of Manchurian candidates. It was set up in Tuskegee, in which is Georgia, right? Or Alabama. Georgia. Alabama. In the 1940s. The experiment is you've got 400, they're all rural, 1940s, dirt poor, black guys with active syphilis, 400 of them, and 400 controls. These people are followed prospectively without treatment into the 1970s. The people who are involved in the Tuskegee syphilis study include a huge long list, I can't remember all the details on, but it includes like the County Medical Society. The administration of the study in the 60s was actually taken over by the Center of Disease Control, the Surgeon General, the American Heart Association. All kinds of people were witting, knowledgeable, and aware of the study and approved its ongoing nature well into the 60s and even into the 1970s, in complete violation of all known ethics. Well, okay, so that was kept kind of secret. Nobody heard about it except some of these medical bigwigs. No, I have a 1965 paper that I photocopied at the medical school called Untreated Syphilis in a Male Negro, a 20-Year Follow-Up. This stuff is published right in the medical literature. It's looking everybody right in the face. What happens when you have 400 illiterate, rural, black guys with active syphilis untreated for 40 years? Well, the outcome of the experiment is, you'll be very surprised to hear, they don't do too well, they develop a lot of disease, and they die young. They do another thing. They breathe air. There's another behavior that we can predict of these guys, that is, they eat food. Going down the list, they urinate and defecate. Continuing on with basic human functions, they have sexual intercourse with women. Anybody who's been to medical school will tell you it is 100% guaranteed that if you take 400 black guys with syphilis and do not treat them for the rest of their lives, you are guaranteed to be creating cases of congenital syphilis. The entire medical community knows this for an elementary fact that you learn in first year medical school. It's published in the medical literature and is condoned by all levels of the Old Boy Network in world medicine. This is totally unbelievable and completely factual. So, like, this Manchurian Candidate stuff is like the little Mickey Mouse psych stuff. It's not even heavy duty. So all of this, I mean, you can, the nurse who was the head of the Tuskegee syphilis study throughout its duration actually got an award from the Public Health Service because of her work on the Tuskegee syphilis study. So the now, some of these guys, the individual guys, have gone and testified at the Senate. You can read the book called Bad Blood, and these guys are named as individual human beings. Which individual human beings are victims of military mind control research do we already know? Harold Blauer, the tennis pro who was killed. Frank Olson was killed because he jumped through a window because he took LSD mixed with Cointreau administered by Sidney Gottlieb, administrative head of MKUltra that I've talked to on the telephone. When was the Olson family compensated? He died in like 1955 or something. They were compensated by the president in 1977, I think it was. The reason they figured out what happened, this is the children and the surviving mother. The reason they figured out that in fact this was not just a simple suicide was they read the Rockefeller Report on CIA activities published in 1975, in which the case was described without him being named. So they're reading the Rockefeller Report and they realize that their father actually was killed by experimental LSD. And they're compensated for $750,000. One of the people who testified at the committee hearings in the Senate in 1975 was a technician for Amadeo Marazzi, who was the guy who was the head of Edgware Arsenal, where Paul Hawk got his LSD and mescaline from, who was funded by the Air Force while he was at the University of Minnesota. His research assistant, whose name is Mary Ray, was given a dose of experimental LSD, which resulted in an acute psychotic state for which he was admitted to the hospital, for which I have the medical record. And I'm in contact with a lawyer. I'm going to go up and interview her and get her story in more detail. She talks about a room that was involved in the LSD research, which was called the Leaf Room. So when you were on your acid trip, administered by Amadeo Marazzi, you would be taken into the Leaf Room, which is a room. All surfaces of the room were totally covered with leaves. This is weird stuff. She also was connected into a bunch of other stuff that actually is just like, I'm not going to go into all of it because it's a little weird, but it's two hops from Mary Ray to Iran-Contra. So she is a real person who exists. I know her lawyer. I talked to her lawyer on the phone. I'm going to fly up there. I'm going to interview her. I have the medical record. And the way this works is the stuff that happens now is not going to be declassified for 20 or 25 years. Eventually, we will have the names of people who were victims of these experiments in the 70s and 80s and the 90s. We already have their names for the 50s and the 60s, not really into the 70s. We have the names of specific people who are victims of the Tuskegee syphilis study and the radiation experiments into the 70s. So that's just the way it goes. It's just, you're just pushing back that curtain, and there's always this lag time because you're relying on, U equals the intelligence community, you're relying on public apathy and, oh, well, it was back in the Cold War and it's different now and we joined the Boy Scouts of America and we don't do that anymore. So there's always a disinformation strategy for why it happened a long time ago. We don't do it now. We're very regretful. And we're so regretful that, in fact, we agreed to compensate these victims. In the radiation experiments, it was Oregon. There's a prison in Oregon where men were paid to be subjects to participate in radiation experiments. And what they had done was their testicles were irradiated, so they would get paid a certain fee to participate in irradiation of their testicles. The special arrangements were made so that Catholics didn't participate in the study because they couldn't use birth control, therefore they might give birth to genetically mutated children. So it had to be only non-Catholic participants. Then there was an extra fee that was a little bit fatter if you would agree to have your testicle biopsied to see whether the radiation was dropping your sperm count. When nine of these people pressed their case to the state legislature in Oregon in either the late 70s or early 80s, in its magnanimity, the legislature agreed to compensate them for a total of $2,000 and some for all nine subjects. So this is the way it goes with trying to document this stuff and get it made public and identify the specific individuals. It's a big, slow job. And when you make Freedom of Information Act requests, it's like interacting with any federal bureaucracy. In fact, the CIA has been extremely helpful, extremely polite, very courteous. And when I went to the CIA reading room in Washington, which was a very unusual experience, well, let me just tell you the story because it's kind of a good story. So here I am, Canadian psychiatrist, going down to the Eastern Regional Conference, and the day early, I pop over to the CIA reading room to look at the MKUltra documents to figure out which ones I want to order at 10 cents a page, which they then ship to me, which arrives in my office from UPS with Central Intelligence Agency stamped in the corner. I'm wondering who thinks that's weird. So I show up, and it's just this building in Virginia on a street that's completely unrecognizable, doesn't look like anything. I get dropped off there. I walk in, like, whoo, there's all these guys in uniforms. And here I'm this civilian. And on the wall it says, secured telephone, CIA and DIA only. And I'm kind of standing around, and some guy says, good morning, sir. And so I say, well, I'm here to read some CIA documents. I'm supposed to show up at this location at this time, and here's the letter. And they're going, CIA, geez. And then it's like, who are we going to phone? Are you supposed to tell somebody you're here, or how's this supposed to work? Well, I don't know. I was just told to show up here. Says, well, we don't know who's supposed to meet you. So then I say, well, could I use your phone? He says, yeah, not that phone. This phone over here. So then I phone my secretary, like, what's the telephone number of the contact person? So she gives it to me, and I say, well, you're supposed to contact this person at this phone number. Oh, it's okay. We found out who it is. They're going to be down in a minute. So then I sign in. I'm escorted up the elevator. It's all like military guys, and I'm sitting on the elevator thinking, now, which one of these guys is doing surveillance on me? I come up to the floor, and we're walking along, and it's a federal building. Like, the floor is under repair. There's all kinds of construction stuff lying around and construction guys. And I go walking down the corridor accompanied by the CIA person, and I go into the first room, which has got like a steel vault door, and it says Secured Area Treasury Department. So I go into that room. They close the door. I'm now in a secured area. She says, okay, sign in here. I think I signed in. I forget. Then I go through another secured steel door into a second secured area, because I can't enter that secured area except from another secured space. And then I sit down, and they bring in all the documents on a little cart, and she gives me like 15 or 20 pencils, beautifully sharpened. And there's a notepad and everything. It's, here's, you order which documents you want at the end of the day. And there's a woman who's at least 80, if not 85, who's a retired volunteer sitting there watching me all day. But I'm in the room that I'm in that's a secured space. The doorway is open back to the hallway that I came down from the elevator to go into the first secured space to go into the... So then I'm sitting there working away on this huge amount of documents all day, like just work, 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 work. Somewhere in the middle of the day, this old woman, so I'm thinking, now, is this old woman trying to pump me for information? What's her report going to be back at the end of the day? She says, well, what's that stuff you're reading? And I'm trying to act cash. I just say, well, it's just a bunch of, you know, mind control documents from the 50s and 60s. She says, well, is that stuff classified? I said, no, it was declassified a long time ago. She says, so what do they need me here for? I go, I don't know. And I stop talking to her and focus down on my paper. So then I get distracted by a couple of black guys who are walking down the corridor have something to do with the construction. The 85-year-old white-haired woman who's watching me has to go to the restroom, so they're assigned to watch me from the door. And they're like some black guys who start joking around about, oh, this guy's pretty dangerous. We'll have to watch him. And then at the end of the day, I leave. That's my experience. So, but the main contact person is like very friendly, very polite, very efficient, very helpful. And it's through this process. I mean, they've given me these documents. They're the ones who've made it possible to prove that the CIA has been creating Manchurian candidates. But I've got all these other requests in on MK Search and all this MK Naomi and stuff, and I'm going to put one in on Stargate. If you want to do a request on an individual, it turns out that you have to establish his place and date of birth, his full name, his date of death, the fact that he was an American citizen, and you have to have public documentation of his death before they will do a search, which is protecting proper protection of people. So you got to do all of this background research to find out, like, when did Carl Pfeiffer die and where did he die, and get a newspaper clipping from Atlanta to document that. Then you send all that information into them, and you ask for information on this particular guy, and they send you back the MK Ultra document that you already have, that you already know is due to him, except now his name's not whited out. So a lot of it is just kind of like dealing with the federal bureaucracy, and it's just really, really, really slow. And they say, like, we've only got two secretaries, and we've got a million requests, and we're too overloaded, and we don't have our new computer system, and we can't get this stuff to you, but we're working on it. And it's just a very, very, very slow, laborious process to get this stuff, especially if it's already declassified and it's indexed, then you can get it fairly quickly, like the MKUltra stuff. If it's just being organized, it isn't yet officially declassified, then you get in a line, and you're piggybacked on top of the first requester. When the first requester gets the stuff, you'll get it as well. And so, like MKSearch, I've been waiting for a couple of years already. So it's like trying to change the way agriculture is administered in the United States. It's this huge, laborious process. You're just trying to egg the bureaucracy on and on and on and on. But just to kind of repeat the editorial comment, basically, I don't have a beef with the intelligence agencies. My beef is with the psychiatrists and the psychologists. Other question or comment at all?
Do you know whether or not, if you are being surveyed, or
do I know if I'm being surveyed?
There's
Well, I've been approached by millions of people at conferences. I don't know if any of them are operatives or not. I've had no like negative, scary, frightening, intimidation, threat. My office has not been broken into. Doesn't look nothing about mail tampering. Nothing's gone missing. No patients have done anything really dangerous and weird towards me. Nobody's disappeared. No dead chickens on my doorstep. Nobody's hustled me into a black car and all of a sudden I'm in Topeka, Kansas, and I don't know how I got there. Nothing like that has happened. So I just assume that if it hasn't happened by now, it's already too late. Like, what's the point? So part of this whole story, which I didn't get into, is the personal side of it, is how do you work your way through all this material and get more and more and more and more and more of these connections and not succumb to terminal paranoia? And it's really just sort of a zen... of not the zen of investigating military mind control. I mean, you just have to stay centered and decide not to be paranoid and not let it get to you. And because you can get off into like how many witnesses to the JFK assassination are dead, and what about Pan Am 103, and what about Timothy McVeigh's computer chip in his buttock, and you can really get out there real fast. When he was first arrested, Timothy McVeigh said that he had a computer chip implanted in his buttock. But on the other hand, I would assume, like, I hope that the intelligence agencies are not so fast asleep. I mean, basically, I was saying to John, it's narcissistically injurious to think that they're not paying any attention at all. I can't take that. And I know for a fact they have a file on me because I've filed millions of Freedom of Information Act requests. And the other thing I know is that I got my green card in 1994 at the highest level of green card there is. It's a level where you don't have to even have a job or any visible sign of report. And I got this immigration lawyer who put in my whole CV and all my publications and letters from people and stuff together. And so that involves, obviously, a security screen by the State Department, which means connected to justice and connected to the FBI and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I know I've been screened through all that kind of mechanism and come out. In fact, I had to go to Calgary for the green card, and the consulate there came up and shook my hand and said, "Boy, I bet you we got a lot of disassociation disorders right here. We could really use you." I think they're trying to pretend that they're never going to get uncovered and just carry on with life and enjoy their retirements. Overall, what's going on now, I assume that there's still a lot of funding of research through cutouts with unwitting investigators. I assume there's a bunch of witting investigators. There's another, let's see here, we've got 10 minutes. Let me tell you about another arm that I know is going on currently. That's artificial intelligence research. And I know that, for instance, Marvin Mursky at MIT in his book, The Society of Mind, he acknowledges extensive Office of Naval Research funding. That goes back to John Lilly, who is tied into the LSD network, who treated dolphins with LSD, who's involved in communication with dolphins. Dolphins, for a documented fact, have been used to swim up to ships to blow them up with bombs attached to the dolphins in the Vietnam War. We hear weird stuff from patients sometimes about dolphins and mind control. John Lilly's tied into the LSD network, and I've got him attending CIA-sponsored LSD symposia. He invented the flotation tank. Flotation tank research is in-network and all the sensory deprivation stuff and mixed in with hallucinogens. And he wrote a program on metaprogramming in the human computer, which is a early artificial intelligence treatise that basically defines a modularity model of the human mind, which is the dominant model of neural networks, all that area of artificial intelligence, and a whole bunch of different Office of Naval Research funding. And that's ongoing up to the present. But there's Office of Naval Research funding for that kind of research. Also for rat physiology, rat psychology research that has to do with modularity of brain functions and modularity of memory, which all is directly relevant to creating Manchurian candidates because you want to know the modular organization of the brain. Which hypothesis now? Well, that is a very good question. You're assuming that I might have the answer. The answer is, if the hypothesis is that... Now, I'm not saying like everybody on the False Memory Syndrome Advisory Board consciously is aware of this. Most of them are like totally out to lunch. I've never heard of it or thought of it. The point would be that the intelligence agencies have somehow penetrated the false memory movement and are trying to spin it in that direction and amplify it for those purposes. And candidate people for intelligence oversight would include Martin Oren, Jolly West, Richard Offshey, etc. Maybe Michael Persinger. So if that's the hypothesis, and the basic thing is to cover up government Manchurian candidates, why are the patients all coming with SRA stories? Well, that could be accidentally related and just part of a cultural hysteria and not real. The other paranoid conspiracy theory is that the intelligence agencies subcontract with the cults to prime the children to be good subjects for really, really complicated Manchurian candidates. Because if you just start with G.I. Joe at age 19, you can't, you know, get an intensely polyfragmented, multi layers of defense system in place very easily. So one of the pieces of logic I didn't mention is if you go back to J.H. Esterbrooks, and you're in the Second World War, he's creating one alter personality in adult recruit. Okay, let's look at the stage that computers are at in the Second World War and run up to 1996. We have to postulate that the technical advance and the increase in complexity in mind control research and operations has at least somewhat paralleled the complexity of artificial intelligence, all the rest of science, etc. So if they're still doing it, it's got to be a lot more complicated. And you've got to you can't get to a lot more complicated from a foundation of a normal 18-year-old military recruit. So that's the ultimate paranoid conspiracy theory. It's a matter of opening windows in the program. The first window that comes open is the SRA. The window behind that is the military mind control. Alternatively, the whole SRA thing could itself be deliberate disinformation that's been implanted in the culture. Broaden the question a little bit. What's my political recommendation on what should be the legal liability of government-induced Manchurian candidates for criminal acts that they perpetrated? And I would say that we should have a double amnesty program. And this is for strategic reasons. It's like politics is the art of the possible. Some people could say this is unethical and this is like, caving in and playing the game. I think that we have to have a double amnesty program for any criminal acts conducted by government-induced Manchurian candidates in the course of their government operations, and also amnesty for their handlers. Because if we don't have that, then the drive to keep it all covered up is too great. So we can't get this wound down. My basic argument is that I think this is, the intelligence community has been sold a bogus bill of goods by these guys like G.H. Esterbrooks and all his heirs down the line. That it's overkill, it's unnecessary, it's ridiculous. You can just drop it and there will be no operational loss. Do I know that for a fact? I haven't got the faintest idea. But that's what I would propose to them. They could do their own analysis. If we're going to stop it and let it come out into public, that'll never happen if the individual handlers and operators in the intelligence community are going to be nailed in public and personally responsible. So there has to be a double amnesty program, but then there has to be financial compensation for the victims who get identified. That is less likely to happen if the compensation comes out of the intelligence budget. Therefore, it ought to come out of general federal funds and ought not to reduce intelligence community funding. Otherwise, you've set up systemic disincentive to this stuff ever being declassified.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for the International Connection this week. That concludes the lecture by Dr. Colin Ross. Next week, we'll be featuring an interview with Dr. Colin Ross, expanding on some of the issues that were raised in this three-part lecture. You're listening to 88.1. Transcripts of this